Friends, did you know that the temperature at night can have one of the biggest impacts on your sleep quality? If you often wake up too hot or too cold, I can definitely recommend Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. In addition to their self-cooling properties for better quality sleep, Miracle Made bedding has awesome self-cleaning properties so you can say goodbye to stale odors. And you'll get the luxurious, super comfortable feel we're all looking for without the ridiculously high price tag. I have to be honest with you guys, I truly love my white Miracle Made sheets. They are so clean, they are so crisp, and they prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. This leaves them to stay cleaner and fresher 3 times as long than other sheets. Most other sheets, they're teeming with little allergy and acne-causing bacteria that you do not want in your bed. So, why don't you just listen to me and go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code thestacks at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it is backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you are not 100% satisfied, you get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks and use the code thestacks to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode and making my bedtime even better. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today I'm speaking with Tommy Orange, who is the author of There There, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and now he's back with a brand new novel called Wandering Stars. Wandering Stars is a sweeping, heart-wrenching story that begins in 1864 Colorado and follows several generations of a Native American family cursed by institutional indoctrination. The book deals with faith, addiction, and generational trauma, and we talk about all that and of course, a lot more on today's episode, including my and Tommy's shared love of Oakland, which is, of course, our hometown. Remember, Elise Hugh will be back on March 27th to discuss our book club pick, Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. And if you like what you hear today, consider joining The Stacks Pack, which is our community for book lovers, which you can find at patreon.com/thestacks. By joining, you make it possible for me to make this show, and you get perks for yourself, like our virtual book club, access to our Discord community, bonus episodes, and more. It's $5 a month, so please head to patreon.com/thestacks and join. Here's a shout out to some of our newest members of the Stacks Pack: Marie Muller, Margaret Leonard, Angeline, Amy Jo Benavides, Hannah Gross, Macon Lee, Hannah Way, Maggie M., Whitney, and Catherine. Thank you all so much for joining the Stacks Pack. And of course, as always, thank you to the entire Stacks Pack for holding the show down. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Tommy Orange. All right, everybody. This is an episode that I feel like has been a long time coming because I started this podcast in 2018, right when this author's first book was coming out. I was not important enough to get him on the show then, and I have been patiently waiting to talk to the author and Pulitzer Prize nominee. Is that what they call it? I don't know. Tommy Orange. He wrote There, There, and his new book is Wandering Stars. Tommy, welcome to the Stacks.
Hi, Tracy. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited.
Had there been an attempt to get me on last time around?
No, not really. I mean, like, I read the book and I loved it. And I was like, it would be so cool to talk to that guy. And then, I mean, you know, I was literally like trying to figure out what the show was. So it wouldn't have been a good time. I feel like now I've had like 6 years to think about what I could ask you. And now I get to do that. But no, your team did not like shit on me and be like, no, little girl, never. No, good. No, no. We always start here. In about 30 seconds or so, can you just tell folks what Wandering Stars is about?
Yeah. Sorry, I thought you meant in 30 seconds That's when I would start telling.
Oh,
you,
no.
you mean say it in 30 seconds.
Yes, I've been doing this for 6 years. You're the first person to say that to me, which I actually am obsessed with.
Okay, I'm still figuring this out because the book just came out yesterday, and here's my attempt.
Okay.
So we start back in 1864, Sand Creek Massacre. There is a young man running away from the massacre. He ends up at a prison castle where his jailer is Richard Henry Pratt, who uses the example of these prisoners of war at the prison castle as the blueprint for the Indian boarding schools. This young man who ran away from the massacre and then got released from the prison has a son who ends up going to the boarding schools. He runs away and ends up in Oakland. He runs away from the boarding schools and their sort of cruelty. He is in love with Opal, and it's a name familiar from people who have read there. And they have a child, and that child sort of leads you all the way up until the events that happened in the first book, and they're there. And the second part of the book is the aftermath, and this follows one family from there, and how they recover from this shooting that happened at the powwow at the end of there.
Okay. I feel like what I've seen is like people are calling it a prequel sequel, which I've never heard that before, but I kind of love it. Were you thinking of the book in that way as a prequel sequel? Or when you went into it, did you know that you were going to do both before and after sort of the events of there?
Not at all. I didn't want to write historical stuff at all. Everyone knows how much historical stuff has, you know, we've covered the historical ground for Native people. It's every year we look back at the 400-year-old history of how we relate to the Pilgrims. Cowboys and Indians is like in the American imagination, just stamped forever as like, you know, that is what we are. And we still struggle to get, you know, depicted, if we do at all, in a modern way on TV. Things are changing now, TV and movies. You know, Killers of the Flower Moon is about to sweep at the Oscars, but it's very much a historical film. I mean, I don't know if it's going to sweep. It's like got tons of nominations.
Yeah.
So I was against historical stuff, but I stumbled into this piece of history that happened to be my tribe's history. So I'm enrolled in the Cheyenne Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma, but we are Southern Cheyenne, and everyone who's enrolled in our tribe, you know, if you're Arapaho or Cheyenne, it's not, you know, their names when it comes to Native people and tribes are, it's a confusing thing. But we know that we're Southern Cheyenne, and there's not that much Southern Cheyenne history in American history. And this is not the best piece of history to be a part of, but it's an important piece, because the boarding schools were devastating to us, and, to be like the wicked seeds of this awful thing just felt compelling to write about. And there's there's this thing that happens, while the prisoners are there at the prison castle, where they pour like plaster over them and make what's called life masks out of them, because they want to measure their heads to prove that basically if their heads are smaller, that's why they're savages, and that's why white men are smarter or better or whatever. And they call them life masks. And so like pouring whiteness over them and like keeping these like plasters of them as like the blueprint for assimilation, where they're basically trying to turn the children white, was just like a rich metaphor, but it's not a metaphor. Like, it really happened. These casts, they still exist at the Peabody Museum on the Harvard campus. So there was just a lot there that I felt like I could write into. And then I discovered that two of the prisoners' names who were actually there were Star and Bearshield, and Bearshield's a family name from there. And I feel like, okay, I can do a generational thing, and that'll be the tie that gets us to the aftermath. And the book's broken up into before and aftermath. And the pictures that they took of the prisoners and then of the children were very much like before and after, like look what how they looked when they came and then after we civilized them. So the book sort of playing on that sort of thing, except before and aftermath and aftermath of the powwow. And so I found a way, it took 6 years to write. So it wasn't easy to find a way to have both the prequel and sequel thing happen. All of the naming of what it is kind of painful to talk about. Like, is it a prequel or sequel standalone? And sequels kind of like, it feels like it's cheapened stuff. And, but like extended universe sounds Marvel, and I don't know how to talk about it without making it feel compromised. But it is essentially a prequel sequel thing, and it wasn't planned, and it sort of snuck up on me and became that.
What's interesting is like hearing you say how that's difficult to like figure out how to name it or like what to call it or what language to use around it. I feel like that's sort of like a really apt metaphor for your work in general. I feel like you're a writer who sort of is writing around convention or like trying to do things differently. And so I struggle like with naming and like putting your work in a place in my brain. So it's interesting to hear you say that about just like how to talk about the book, because I can feel that tension even as a reader, because like I said, like calling it prequel sequel, like doesn't quite feel right, but like that's sort of like how they're pitching it. And so that's how it's in my brain. But you know, even like there's parts of the book, like when you talk about the names to call, you know, Indigenous, Native, or Indian people, and you're sort of grappling with like, what is that name? Like, how do we name things? And so I guess the question is, how do you think about naming things? How important is the naming of things to you as a person who uses their words for their work?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing for me is figuring out the language for some of these painful things is where the possibility for transformation happens. Because when things are left unsaid, or if they're said wrong, there's pain there and there's damage there and there's harm. And when you can find a way to express stuff clearly or in ways that feel good to you as a writer, when you're working with language and you can clarify things even for yourself and hopefully for the reader, then there's movement as opposed to, you know, the stagnancy or the staticness of silence.
Yeah. There's a part in the book where you're talking, the two brothers, Orville and Luther, are talking and they're like kind of play fighting and they call each other these nicknames, and you're like, you know, we call it they both hate the nickname, but it's also like this way of saying, I love you. And that is, to me, is totally like that question about how we name or like how we use words to like get at the heart of the thing. Because I have a family nickname that I'm not wild about, but also anybody who calls me it, I'm like, okay, you're in. Like, you're like, that's like a way of like claiming me and me claiming them. And so there's so many moments like that actually in the book where you like hit the thing right the fuck on the head, where I'm like, I know that. And I'm sure you've had that feeling as a reader too, where like you read a sentence and you're like, oh my God, that's the thing.
I mean, that's what draws you, everybody, to reading. I feel like it's like, it hasn't been said before, but as soon as you read it, you're like, yes, it needed to exist somewhere, because it's just been inside me and I didn't even really acknowledge it until I saw it.
Yeah. I'm going to stick on naming for one more question, which is, how do you name your characters? I mean, you mentioned before that you found these names in the history, in the archives, but how about everybody else?
I don't know where some names came from. So we get this thing, some natives, like 15%, I think, or less, get what's called per cap. You may have heard of it before. There's an assumption that the general Americans have. I read some survey that thinks that we all just get like monthly checks. Which is absurd, because the poverty rate of Native people is like insanely high. But my tribe, we do get checks, and growing up, it was like $150 every December. And like, I would like actually be able to buy gifts for my family members. And that's what the money meant, like with my own money. Now it's like 500 two times a year or whatever. Anyway, so for there, I was on a list of names of people who needed to update their address to get their per cap check. And I was just looking at Cheyenne names and just randomly picked some of the names, like Opal Viola as like a first and middle name came from that list. And I believe, and the last name Loneman, and the rest are just kind of made up. And I don't know where they come from. Names are hard. Like, they're one of those like seemingly arbitrary things, but that also like matter specifically in a very like deep way. Like the connection and whether it fits the personality, all of that really matters. So they tend to come like pretty fast. And when they come, I tend to keep them. I don't do a lot of switching. Like Sean Price, in this book came like as Sean Price immediately. The name, I didn't do very much messing around with that. So I don't know how to answer the question, because it's somewhat mysterious still, the process.
Yeah. It's so funny. I ask a lot of novelists this, and the answers just like run the gamut. And it's one of the reasons I love to ask the question, because I'm always like excited to hear how people do it. I do have to say, Sean Price is my personal favorite character in the book.
Oh, thank you.
I love Sean Price. He's an Oakland boy, and I'm an Oakland girl. I mean, they're almost all Oakland people except for the first two generations, but we will talk extensively about Oakland. Don't you worry. I want to talk, though, first about addiction, because that is a huge piece of this book. And I'll be very transparent with you. You know Kia Say Lehman. He's a friend of mine. And I know that he worked, like he's acknowledged in the acknowledgments that he was like in conversation with you as you were writing this book. And he and I talk about everything I read just about. And sometimes when I'm really nervous to talk to someone, I will tell him. And this morning, I actually called him at about 6:30 in the morning and was like, Kia Say, I have a question for Tommy Orange that I cannot articulate about addiction and faith and God, because there are these two really big pieces of the book that come up. And I know that he's writing towards something, but I cannot get at the thing. And he said to me, he said, just say to Tommy, what the fuck were you trying to do with those things? And so the question is from KSA through me, what the fuck were you trying to do with those two things?
I love that. And I love KSA. And I'm glad yes. He was able to be a part of this.
He's always with me.
You know, first of all, they are two things that have, for better or worse, shaped my life completely. So I grew up in an evangelical household, or at least my mom was, and we were forced to go to church every Sunday. And my mom, I just found out actually last year when I was born, my mom, as my dad was rolling her into the hospital in a wheelchair, she was speaking in tongues. So to give you a sense of how intense it was, like it wasn't like we went to church sometimes, evangelical happened to be it. It was like Shiloh Church on School Street down off 35th, 1,000 person congregation, loud and end of the world, you know, coming, like intense stuff. So God is something I was never not going to be thinking about, writing about, feeling about, and faith just is tied to that. Then addiction, you know, just in the same way shaped my life. Everybody in my family has struggled besides my mom, but like full-blown alcoholics, everybody else. And I've had a lot of struggle myself. So it's just, I think I was always going to be writing about both of those things. And you know, what I'm trying to get at, I think, maybe not as they relate, but there is a lack, I think, that the characters feel, and they're not even sure what they're lacking. And it requires a certain amount of faith to go at something to try to get that, to fill the thing. And sometimes when you go at what you think is the cure, it ends up being something that harms you, like drugs or alcohol or like opiates for Orville. And I was really trying to write about addiction with complexity. And I think a lot of addiction writing can fall into kind of like this dual nature of like good and evil. Like there's an arc of like recovery comes and then you're all good, and sobriety good, being an addict bad. And you know, some of my characters are like just starting to feel things once they take drugs, which is not usually the narrative. It's often like about numbing something. So sometimes when people are traumatized early, what happens is they shut off everything and protect themselves and can't feel anything, and that's the problem. And drugs can mean this other thing. And you know, Orville wonders like why all artists or musicians tend to be drug users or alcohol users. And I'm more wondering at a lot of these things and the nuances of them, because that's something that I think about a lot and like I said, has shaped my life. So I think they're inextricable, and I think I'll always be writing about both things. But right. I do think my next book is not going to be as addiction heavy. I sold my next book at the end of last year. But
congratulations.
Thank you. But there will be elements of God and faith, and maybe a little poking fun at sort of Indian loving white moms who are kind of new agey. And so maybe even a lighter side of God and faith as well.
Right. I think it's interesting because in my mind, like when it comes to sobriety, at least, you know, in America, it is tied so closely to like Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. And there's like so much language about God and like higher powers and resigning yourself to that. And so I think as I was reading the book, I was thinking a lot about like what it means to embark on like a sobriety journey without having that, like what that is like. And I feel like I still don't know the question. But I do feel like you were commenting a little bit or writing into a little bit that sort of dichotomy about like the necessity for faith, but also the fact that maybe not everyone has that faith or accesses that faith or wants to have that faith, but that those people too might not want to be using drugs or alcohol.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're sort of like hitting on my psychology and my journey too. Like I am on a kind of sobriety journey because I struggle and have struggled and I haven't gone as extreme as some people do and even in my own family, but I'm sort of like a harm reduction case and I understand that I have to be careful and I was just called recently by this woman that we are very close with. She's a Lakota woman who her family goes way back in Oakland and she's a healer. And she described me to my wife as the most spiritual, non-spiritual person that she's ever met. Because I have all this spiritual baggage from my parents telling me the only thing that matters to us is your relationship to God when I was six. And I think I was asking about like a girlfriend, wow. I was asking about a girl I had a crush on. And they were asking if she believed in God or like what her religious background was. And I'm like,
I'm like six. We're six. You're like, is Oreos a religious background? Because she's very into those. That's incredible. That's incredible. So I know that you also through your acknowledgments and through the acknowledgments of Kaveh's book and talking to Kaveh on the podcast, I know that you two exchanged pages for years on these two books. And it's funny because I think part of me wishes I didn't know that now because I would have loved to read this book and not have been thinking about Martyr. But of course, they're so closely tied in my head and I could feel so much of each other. I could feel so much of Kaveh in this book because I didn't know, when I read Kaveh's book, I didn't know that you worked on it. So you weren't in my mind. And also I don't know. So I could feel him in this book because I had just spoken to him. Like it was like very much framing my reading. But I'm wondering, like, did you have someone that you worked with there on in a similar way? Or was this a new experience for you? And if it was a new experience, what did it open up or change for you as a writer?
I mean, I think when I started there, like nobody knew I was even trying to write. Maybe like my best friend. And like I would read pages to my wife. And she was the only one that knew I was working on something. So that was just like when we would have very little time when we weren't working and sort of we just had a new baby. And so when the baby went to sleep, there was like this little chunk of time where we would sit on the back porch. We were living in West Oakland then. And I would read like the latest thing because I was getting up at 5 a.m. to write before work. And so I would have fresh pages to read and new people. And she knew the community and I wanted it to feel real to the community. And so she was that, some version of that, like reading out loud to her and getting her reaction. She was at the beginning of writing there. And then I was in school, then my MFA, and there was like an official sort of like my peers right. and workshop. And that's not the same thing. So the Kaveh thing was new. I mean, after I graduated, I traded pages with Therese Myatt, and we sort of raced to completion together in a way that we were changing pages. But the thing that me and Kaveh have developed is totally new and is ongoing. Like we're trading pages for our next books, and I'm already excited about his. We started thinking of it as like, you know, musicians get to hang out and jam together, and writers have to like suffer alone and in a vacuum. And, And so we started doing it every Friday, and it doesn't feel like workshoppy space at all. It doesn't feel like I'm your friend, so I'm going to tell you some hard words about right. what you need to do. It's very much like nice riff. You know, I love yeah. this. Keep going. Like, it's very like cheering on and having him read it, because I respect and love him. It makes me write different. I'm writing into, you know, I'm writing into his ear, because I respect the way he'll hear it and, right. and the what he'll say to it will motivate me and give me momentum. So it's very new in that we have this consistent thing, and now that we did this, you know, together, these two books between 2019 and then they were published within a month of each other, and he's at Knopf, and we have the same editor. It was like this insane thing.
I
that
love
happened.
That.
So because it sort of became this actual real thing, it just feels like there's no breaking it now. It's just become a thing.
Yeah. I love that. I just like the idea of like finding ways to collaborate. I obviously do this podcast, and it's very, you know, isolating. It's just me. Obviously it's not isolating when I get to talk to people, but everything else around it is like can be pretty like, you know, lonely, and we record and then things don't come out for a while. So I don't get a lot of feedback, and just the thought of you all finding a way to sort of make feedback and collaboration possible in your work is really, it's just exciting to hear about. It's so different than how so many other authors that I've spoken to work. So I just love that. And I also just think you guys are both really great. And so I sort of love that too, of like two like just really good writers, like being bestie writer friends is like really adorable to me. I want to ask you, this is sort of a heady question, but I'm wondering what you, Tommy Orange, as a writer, are hoping to maybe clarify, correct, illuminate around addiction, around native urban life, around family. I mean, you're writing into these really big generational trauma, these really big like themes and ideas. And I'm wondering, like, that just, to me, it feels like taking on so much. So I'm wondering, as like one person writing into one computer, maybe sending a few pages to Kaveh, like what your hope is for your work and these ideas.
So I think Native people have been dehumanized pretty extensively over a really long period of time. And the scope of the work that's necessary to correct that is big, and I am just trying in my small way to address, like, we have this pilgrim story, and this is the way it's taught in education in institutions, and we teach almost nothing else, so people don't understand the context of Native life, and that does a lot of damage to us, and we don't get representation, and I'm trying to restore humanity through writing stories about us and what we really look and sound and feel like, what we think, what we think about, expressing complexity and nuance, posing questions that may not have answers, but like, this is what we're like, and just, you know, showing the contemporary picture, because it's been so absent from the American imagination, and that really does a lot of damage to us. We're just now getting some, you know, some space to tell our stories and to be seen on screens. And that feels really good. I already know, like, a lot of people don't know what it feels like to not ever be reflected in popular culture or in education, like the absence of story. It feels like something. It feels like a hole inside you. And so I'm trying to address by telling this story what that feels like, so that people understand the context of Native life and how, you know, addiction might make more sense, or family life and the brokenness or the lack of connection to our culture might make more sense, and the burden might stop being put on our moral failings or weakness as a people, and you might understand, like, oh, okay, like, I guess some of these things makes more sense now that I understand the extent to which what you've had to get through. Because I don't feel like we're given compassion because we haven't been given humanity. And when you think of somebody as less than, it doesn't require compassion to think about them. So trying to build that in through story and giving context, I think, is the best way I could say it.
Does it feel like a lot of pressure to do that?
When we're talking like this, I feel pressure.
Sorry. I don't want you to feel pressure.
I mean, like when we get into the heady space of like, what's the responsibility of the writer and what could it possibly do? And what are the problems with the narrative? And how much can one book actually address? But when I'm writing, you know, I don't feel the pressure. I try to, like, all the stuff that's going to stop me from writing or sort of mangle my process, I try to, like, get out of the space before I'm going at it. And it, you know, sometimes that doesn't work, but you have to write anyway a lot of the time.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time you saw yourself, like, really reflected back in a way that you were, like, excited about?
Like in a piece of, like, art or
it could be writing, yeah, any art, music, television. I don't know. Just you were saying that, you know, there was a feeling of not being present in those spaces. Yeah. So I'm just wondering if you remember the first time where you were like, holy shit, that's me.
I mean, I want to say it took as long as like Reservation Dogs. This is like 2021, like contemporary Native life. There's a ton of like great fiction that I love, but it doesn't mean that I saw myself in it. And there's a lot of reservation stories, and I didn't grow up in that context. So like I said, no shade to anybody. Like I love so much of the canon, but I didn't have that feeling of like, okay, that's that I feel seen, you know, in the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back and talk about Oakland. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out. When I started podcasting, an online store was truly the furthest thing from my mind. Now I'm selling super cute sweatshirts, tote bags, other bookish swag, and it's so easy. All because I use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit $1 million order stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, they have you covered. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system for wherever or whatever you're selling. If you came to the Stacks tour and bought merch, that was the in-person POS system. I'm just telling you, I use it. I love it. Turn your casual browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. It is 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. In case you don't know, I was an emotional mess when I first saw the Stax merchandise on a listener while out in public. After starting this podcast and building a community, I had to be talked into creating merchandise, and Shopify made it possible. There is a 0% chance I would have merch if Shopify wasn't so easy to use. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/thestacks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/thestacks now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/thestacks.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season two is out now from Lemonada Media.
Okay, we're back. Time to talk about Oakland. I can't wait. My hometown, your hometown. Are you still in Oakland?
Yes, I'm back in Oakland as opposed to still, because I was gone for a while. I've been back 2 years.
That's what I thought.
2 years, yeah.
And listen, I've said this many times. I felt it so deeply in reading this book. When I read your writing about Oakland, I live in LA now. I feel like I'm back home. Like, your writing about Oakland is, to me, the best writing I have read about Oakland. I think maybe because we're similar ages, I think, you know, that we have some shared, I think, feelings about Oakland based on what you've written and what I've read. But I'm just wondering how you think about Oakland in your work. Will you ever write outside of Oakland? Like, do you have plans to write about other places? Don't just stay in Oakland forever. But I'm just curious about how Oakland plays into your process and your creativity.
Well, you know, I think it feels so wrong that Oakland has not, and there are a lot of books that are out there that I don't know about, and ones that just get less attention but do exist. But overall, this is just a big general statement. Oakland does not get a lot of love in the literary world. Like, it's, when I was thinking about a novel about Oakland, I had to go back to Gertrude Stein and Jack London. And then, like, Ishmael Reed was like a blues walk in Oakland was important too, but he's not even from Oakland. So there's 10 billion New York novels, right? And is it because Oakland isn't fascinating? Obviously not. Is it because it's not, like, doesn't have good material, rich material to write about? Obviously not. So I feel like I'm writing to resist the idea that Oakland is not a place to write about. And it's also my home. It's where my memories live. It's got so much life to it, complexity, realness, grit, love. Like, people who love Oakland or from Oakland there's a certain kind of earned love that you have for Oakland. It's not like, because it's the prettiest, happiest place on earth. It's because you earned the love, and you went through years, you know, sometimes that were hard, sometimes hard to love Oakland, or, you know, love whatever situation you had going on. So there's a lot of reasons to love Oakland. I think, you know, my next book is set in Oakland and contemporary. And I imagine if I have a long career and I keep being able to write, and AI doesn't take over all creative jobs, I could write about somewhere else. But with the absence or the lack of writing about Oakland, if I have the opportunity to, that's what I know, and that's what I'm interested in. And that's probably what I'll keep writing about. I just finished a screenplay. It's an original screenplay, feature film, for a studio. I don't think I can say too much about it, but the characters in it are Oakland based, even though it's kind of a road trip thing. They're Oakland-based. Did a short film that's a very Oakland short film. And I'm starting to brainstorm with one of my best friends who's going to go on the East Coast part of the book tour with me for Wandering Stars. We're starting to dream up a TV series that will be based in Oakland. So the things that I have lined up just immediately, it's all still Oakland because of my love for it. And like I said, the lack of there being there, you know, the summer that there came out, Blind Spotting came out, and Sorry to Bother You came out. And that felt like,
right.
Instead, I thought it might be leading to something like Oakland Stories. Mm-hmm. And it felt, looking back, it felt like a moment. And so I just, you know, we have the Blind Spotting TV show, and that's great. But I just feel like there's no reason why we shouldn't have some kind of like consistent work coming out about Oakland by people from Oakland.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I feel like Oakland is such a historic place. Like, there's so much nonfiction sort of like history of Oakland. Like, obviously the Black Panthers, and like I'm thinking of like Fruitvale Station and like the Oscar Grant story. Like, there's these moments in history that happen in Oakland, but I do feel like Oakland is so devoid of like getting the fiction treatment. And I mean, I'm even just like thinking about like the sports in Oakland, and like we're like so many storied franchises have been in Oakland, and now they're all almost gone. The A's shortly, which is so fucked up. I need to do a whole podcast about how fucked up that is, but it's just such an interesting place to me in that way, because I feel like in school, you know, we were taught about Oakland, but so were other people who weren't in Oakland. And then as I get older, I feel like there's so little of Oakland that's shown like through the imagination of Oakland and not just tied to the history. So I really appreciate your work, obviously Layla Motley's book.
I'm doing an event with
Easta's book.
I'm doing an sorry to interrupt you.
No.
I'm doing an event with Layla tomorrow in Santa Cruz.
Oh, I love her. I love her so much. But, you know, she's so young. I mean, she's like the brand new generation of Oakland artists. And I just think so much good art and so much good politics and so much good history has come out of Oakland. And yet so little of it is actually like set in Oakland. And so I'm just thrilled to see that. Also, I love the Casper hot dog shout out. You did Casper's with a K. Do you remember Casper's with a C? The one by the McDonald's and the Jack in the Box?
Yeah.
That one is my personal favorite.
I think there still is one on Telegraph. Is that one? Oh. Okay. I think that one might be a
C. That's the Casper's with the C, but yes. That one is closed, like maroon one.
There's another one near there.
Oh.
The Jack in the Box one is like the in the middle of the street.
Yes.
Like,
yes,
yeah,
yes,
the
yes.
Tiny thing. There's another one near there, but maybe that one, I don't know. I read the history. There's a history of it, and there was brothers.
Oh.
And there was like this family divide, and we're going to spell it with a C, and we're going to spell it with a K.
Oh my God. We need that fucking movie novel out of Oakland. Yes, I grew up going to Casper's with the C, the little one with my dad. Like after elementary school, sometimes he would pick me up and be like, we're going to go like on a Wednesday. And we would get the orange creamsicle soda. And it is like one of my most cherished Oakland memories. And when I saw Casper's, obviously it was with a K in the book, but I like got emotional. I was like, oh my gosh. So it's just like those little kind of moments, or like just, I don't know. For people who have never had a book, I guess, written in a place that you're from, maybe you don't understand this, but like, it's just so special because Oakland gets so much shit. Oakland's like the big city that gets a lot of shit. And like, I hate it.
I was in a gym while I was traveling, and there was just a TV on playing Fox News. And I swear to you, for 20 minutes, they were shit-talking Oakland and playing footage of a giant garbage can on fire. And like a, I don't know what you want to call this guy. He was a white, angry white guy that maybe they wanted to make look like Antifa or something. He was driving his car repeatedly into the dumpster that was on fire. And this was supposed to represent the state of Oakland, like how Oakland is just has fallen apart completely. And they just kept showing the same footage of this guy in his Subaru running into a dumpster on fire.
Oh, my God. Well, I guess that is a little bit of Oakland, too. Someone in a Subaru driving into a dumpster fire, sure. But it's not all of Oakland, right? But one of the things Oakland does have that this book has that I was so curious about, and I think part of the reason I really love the Sean Price character is because you wrote into this like about race and about like appropriation when it comes to, you know, blackness in Oakland and the Native identity, and also like this whiteness, because Sean's character is adopted by a white family and they do like a DNA test. And there's sort of this like, it's like the complexity of the diversity of a place like Oakland, where there's so many people and types of people at play and in power and also not in power. So I'm wondering how you think about like that part of Oakland, like the racial identity politics of Oakland, as something that is either exciting to write about or frustrating to live through, or what, however you want to approach it.
Yeah. So, you know, being biracial, having a white mom and a Native dad, growing up on a street in Oakland where like my best friend was half black, half Italian. My other best friend was half black, half Jewish. Another best friend is half Mexican, half Apache, half Irish, half Hawaiian. Like this is like literally on my block. And we all played together. So like this is, to me, it's really interesting to write about. And there's a lot of, you know, identity. Some people talk about it like it's this flimsy extra thing, but it's really core to who people are. And a lot of people think they don't have identity issues, but they're just not wanting to look at it, or it's so homogenized that they don't have to look at it. They don't exist on the fringes or in the margins or in between, so they don't have to think about it, or it doesn't cut them in ways that make them have to clarify. And so they think it's this extra thing that people, like woke people, like to talk about, or some nonsense like that, right?
So
for me, it's really like, it's clarifying and it's interesting, and there's a lot of amazing stuff that isn't written about identity, and Oakland's such a great vehicle for that, and a prism through which to see some of these things, because people like Sean Price exist here, and I especially liked the way Sean Price, the way I was able to write about Sean Price through this, you know, this sort of class prism, because the Oakland Hills, as I'm sure you know, is its own little snow globe world. And there's such a stark difference in class and experience between people from up there. And so him being at this intersection of all these races and not feeling like he belongs to it either, it was just a way to explore a lot of these things that I think about.
When you write in the book, you have all these different characters and we're sort of moving between them. And not only do we change like perspectives, but we also change sort of like tense, or I don't know. I'm the worst writer. You change from like first person to third person or whatever, something like that. You have an MFA. I don't. How is that for you as a writer? Like, how do you keep all that shit straight? Because it feels clear as a reader, but I have to imagine, like, how do you know when you're writing from like sort of Orville's world and you're writing like as like, I did this, I do that. And then sometimes you're writing from Orville's world and we're like outside and we're looking at what he's doing. And like, I don't think a lot of people do that. Usually people decide like I'm in it or I'm outside of it, but you switch between it and different characters move between it. And it just feels very complicated. So I'm wondering how you approach it, how you handle it, how you keep control of it, et cetera.
Yeah, it's questionable. My control is sometimes questionable. But I do, I use it as a tool to figure. There's a couple of different things that it does. So all my characters get this variable POV treatment when I'm going through revision, especially when I don't feel like writing. I'll just assign myself the tedious task to move like, now this is going to go from past tense to present to see if immediacy brings something new, if it brings something to light, if it generates new language. This is a huge piece of the thing that I, the reason that I do it. I will always generate new language when I switch from first to second or third, or when I switch tenses, something new will come about. And often it happens while I'm like bored doing this very tedious work of changing is to wases. or, you know, changing, he did this to I did this, or you did this. It always does something with language that's interesting. And even if I end up changing it back, I might get two sentences that never would have existed. So I get a lot out of doing these changes. And, you know, present tense brings an immediacy that sometimes is required to bring the reader into that moment. And sometimes you want to be sort of hovering above. So like third person Orville, when you first enter 2018, it's third person and Orville's like just recovering and he's on drugs. Like he's sort of detached. He's like taking pills and playing video games. And we're sort of learning about some more brutal aspects of his childhood. And I think being immediately to jump into Orville's skin and hear him say this stuff is a little bit too much. So it was also a way to kind of draw the reader into this Orville's life and his past.
How much are you thinking about audience as you're writing? Like, who is your audience to you, and how do you think about them, I guess?
Well, I think about the reader more so, like is how readable this thing is. I try to consider different ways that the reader might be taking it. Do I need dialogue here? Is this clear enough? Do I need to change this or that so that I'll keep the reader reading? With this book, it's sort of like unavoidable that there will be readers. It's because people are going to want to find out how I did on the second try, no matter whether I succeed or fail. It's a spectacle. So I try not to think about that when in the writing space. I try to keep it abstract and keep to like readability and think about whether I'm being clear for the general reader.
Okay, well, that was one of my next questions, so I might as well ask you. Your first book was a huge fucking success. I don't think there's any other way to put it. How does that impact writing this? Like, what's that like for you? Could you get outside of it? Did it take a while? Like, I mean, I feel paralyzed for you just knowing that you were going to have to write something else one day. So I'm wondering what that was like for you, actually a person who was experiencing it and not just my weird imagination.
I mean, I think the first book took 6 years for much more complicated reasons. You know, I was working. I didn't even know if I was writing a novel. I, you know, was in an MFA and there was all these life things happening and I didn't have anybody like asking me for the book either. This time around, I think it took 6 years for more complicated reasons, partly the pressure. I don't know that I was ever like paralyzed or had writer's block, but it took longer to figure things out. And, you know, I was writing it for a year without even knowing this historical piece was going to be in it. We had 2 years of global pandemic. Those were not good times for me. You know, you hear about some of these writers who like put out 500 page books because of the pandemic and everyone kind of secretly hates them for it.
I hate them.
It wasn't a good time to write. Part of it was just a slog and part of it was not wanting to write the same book, I think was a bigger challenge than the pressure. I really wanted to, and I did, I think certain drafts were the same book. And I wanted to grow and challenge myself to do different things as a writer. And so if there was anything that made it slower, it was really trying to write something new.
Are you excited now that it is in the world?
I am. There's this long waiting period between when you're done and you have to let it go until you hear what people think. And, you know, I'm not one of these people who's going to say, like, I don't care what people think. I know whatever A, B, or C of what I am. Being a writer and having a reader is, you know, a shared experience. There wouldn't be writing without readers. And it is a communal experience. And I care. I want to connect with the reader. I don't need everybody to love it. You know, that would be kind of horrifying if it was just
right.
Like, it's the perfect book. Keep going. Like, that's not helpful. I think engagement with community and people, you know, feeling ways about it is so not having that is really lonely and scary. And, you know, the period of waiting is really hard. So I'm super happy that it's out and obviously happy to get nice things from like publications, but the waiting period, and I could feel this big relief last night when everything was over. I did an event at the City Arts and Lectures with Dave Eggers, and it was a really sweet event. And when it was all over and, you know, the day wasn't a disaster, I just felt this relief of like, okay, it's out. Like there, it's hard to explain exactly. There's an intangible quality to it, but it was like the wait is over. It's out. You know, it doesn't necessarily need to come with like a congratulations or pat on the back. It's more like I don't have to wait anymore. So that feels good.
Did you mark it with anything? Like, did you celebrate with like a cupcake or like a dinner or like, I don't know, wearing your favorite pajamas? Like, do you mark these moments in any way for yourself?
No, I'm not very good about that. I had a great dinner with the City Arts and Lecture people. I shared a steak with my 12-year-old son. And that fact that he came was all really nice. And Dave Eggers like came out of retirement to do the interview. Like he doesn't do a lot of these things. So I felt really grateful for just for the way that the day went. And so I didn't necessarily have anything special.
Okay. Well, it sounds special. This is how you're extra special. What's a word you cannot spell correctly on the first try?
Oh, there's so many. This isn't one that I don't spell right, but Phoenix is one that I always have to like say. I have to say Phoenix to spell it right.
That's like February for me or Wednesday for me. And how do you write? How many hours a day? How often? Music or no? Snacks and beverages? That part's important. Where are you? Like, kind of set the scene for us.
So it's pretty inconsistent, but my favorite place to write is a hotel room. I'm a morning writer and a night writer, more so like hours between like 5 a.m. and probably like 11 are my best. And then I can write again like from like 9 to probably like midnight. Those are all good hours.
So you don't sleep very much.
I usually don't do both the night writing and the morning writing.
Oh, okay.
So it depends.
Okay.
Afternoons are complete garbage for me. Like it's not necessarily a good time. Coffee, like, you know, stimulant based. I don't like have snacks or drinks while I write. That's like what I'll have once I've done the writing to like reward myself.
What is the snack reward when you're done?
Oh, it just depends. There's no consistency. I don't have a lot of like ritual stuff, but one weird thing is I am it's called a prone writer.
So you lay down?
I'm laying down on like flat on my stomach and chest, and like my elbows are propping me up. It's a really weird thing that started.
Wow.
Like my dad laid down a lot when he was watching basketball or TV, and I would lay down with him. And for a while when I was living in the mountains, my writing space was also my son's bedroom. And there were toys everywhere, and there was no place to write except I would be writing surrounded by toys on his carpet. traveling, you know, having to figure out with traveling a lot, having to figure out what times, it's just whenever you can fit it in kind of thing. So I'm inconsistent, but I've had to learn to figure out when I can do it. I don't always have a super consistent schedule. And I think if I did, I would have like better, more clear answers for you. And I would, cause I do thrive with routine, but right now my life is a little bit chaotic.
This is really a specific question for me because it's really more of a request, but do you think you will ever write a book of nonfiction essays? Because I would like you to.
Oh, thank you. For sure I will. I think I have a memoir that I'll write. I have a lot of family stuff going on right now that means I can't at all write about family stuff. But for sure, like, and that's two different things. The essay collection would be something, and the memoir would be something else. And I have a whole bunch of short stories that are already out there. But I have a short story collection in me as well. So I do, you know, I do hope I get to keep writing. And that is one of the things I would love to work on.
Okay, good. I'm eagerly awaiting. Send me pages.
it's really hard for me to write essay. So I have to like trick myself into doing it because I like to bring like a fiction, like a voice to it. And so I have to trick myself into writing about a particular subject to get into like the right place, because I do love writing once it's over. And I do love writing essay form, and I do love thinking about things in that way, but sometimes I drag my feet around, like, it feels like homework sometimes. And so I have to trick myself.
That's so interesting. I just could feel essays in you in reading Wandering Stars. I was like, this person needs to write me some essays. This is a homework assignment. Two more questions and then I'll let you go. One is, for people who love Wandering Stars, what are some other books you might recommend to them that are in conversation with what you've done?
So this book called Calling for a Blanket Dance by Oscar Hokea was something that I read that convinced me to do this sort of generational building. You know, Homegoing does it, a similar thing, just traveling through the generations. 100 Years of Solitude inspired me a long time ago. I haven't read it for a long time, but there's sort of that generational thing going on. Toni Morrison, I read a lot during the pandemic. I mean, I read all of her books during the pandemic, and the best writing always grants me some kind of permission to do something. I don't always know what that is, but it sets something free in me. It gives me the allowance to do something. And her work sort of does that and also makes me feel like I should not even be trying somehow at the same time. So I feel like I was definitely like trying new things and being inspired by her while I was writing there. Love in particular is like a special one. Song of Solomon is like an obvious masterpiece. But Love is kind of this, it holds a special place in my heart. And always will. What else is in conversation? I'm really bad at
you've done great
of, thinking of books on the spot.
That's enough. That's okay, more than okay. enough. It's amazing. Okay. Yeah. You answered. You passed the test. Last one. If you could have one person, dead or alive, read this book, who would you want it to be?
I'm glad you didn't stop the sentence after the word dead. If you could have one person dead.
That's a new question. I just added it. You have one more question.
maybe James Welch. He's he was actually, when you asked me when I was first seen, when I read Winter in the Blood, even though it's a book that's not in my experience at all, there was something in the spirit of his writing and the way he worked with language that I felt a kinship with. So James Welch, he's a native writer. He's no longer with us. That I would love for him. I actually got to meet his wife and hang out in his writing space in Montana, and his wife assured me that he would love my work. So I would be able to know if that would be true.
That's so cool. Well, everyone, you can get your copy of Wandering Stars out in the world now. It exists. It is waiting for you to read it. You can also get there if you haven't read it. I read it. I did not reread it before reading this. And I feel like this book can stand on its own two feet. It is a prequel sequel, but I don't think you need to read there. I think you want to read there because there is fantastic. But if you're like, I just want to read this now, I think you can. I think you could do it. Tommy, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah. Thank you, Tracy. This has been really wonderful.
And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you again to Tommy Orange for being our guest. I'd also like to thank Jordan Rodman for helping to make this conversation possible. Don't forget, the Stacks Book Club pick for March is Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu, which we will discuss on Wednesday, March 27th with Elise Hugh. If you love the show and you want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, you can follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And you can check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tigirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.